We are in 1 Kings chapter 17 still. We started here a few weeks ago, and I'm not sure how long we're going to be here. We're going to be moving right from 17 into 18, because chapter 18 has very much to do with Elijah too. And after that, we're going to be skipping all the way over into 1 Kings to cover a passage or two there that has to do with this prophet. But just remember, as we are studying this, that Elijah was one of those that God spoke to through special means. He's one of those that was raised and lifted up amongst the countrymen, just like Moses and the other prophets. And the purpose of God lifting him up and appointing him was that he would speak on God's behalf, that God would speak to him, and then he would go forth and say what God said to the people. We can imagine, based upon how things have gone so far in our study, that Elijah was not a very popular person in Israel, because his message was not a good one for most of the people of Israel. We've seen how at times the Lord has taken him and hidden him away, in a sense, to protect him. But we've also seen in that how God has miraculously provided for him all of the things that he's needed. Water, food in particular. First at the brook Cherith, and now at Zarephath, where he has appointed a widowed woman there to provide for him. And they've entered into a conversation, and I'm just going to read some of this to get us kind of up to where we happen to be. Let's begin with this conversation with verse 11. As she was going out to verse 8. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and stay there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you." So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, "Please give me a little water in a jar that I may drink." And as she was going to get it, he called to her and said, "Please bring me a piece of bread in your hand." But she said, "As the Lord your God lives, I have no bread, only a handful of flour in the bowl and a little oil in the jar. And behold, I'm gathering a few sticks that I may go in and prepare for me and my son, that we may eat it and die." Then Elijah said to her, "Do not fear. Go, do as you have said, but make me a little bread cake from it first and bring it out to me, and afterward you may make one for yourself and for your son. For thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bowl of flour shall not be exhausted, nor shall the jar of oil be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain on the face of the earth." So she went and did according to the word of Elijah, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The bowl of flour was not exhausted, nor did the jar of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke through Elijah. Now, this is where we're starting today. Now, it came about after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became sick, and his sickness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. So she said to Elijah, "What do I have to do with you, O man of God? You have come to me to bring iniquity, to my iniquity to remembrance, and put my son to death." He said to her, "Give me your son." Then he took him from her bosom and carried him up to the upper room where he was living and laid him on his own bed. He called to the Lord and said, "O Lord, my God, have you also brought calamity to the widow with whom I am staying by causing her son to die?" Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and called to the Lord and said, "O Lord, my God, I pray you, let this child's life return to him." And the Lord heard the voice of Elijah, and the life of the child returned to him, and he revived. Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper room into the house and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son is alive." Then the woman said to Elijah, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth. We speculated on a number of things as we studied this passage, and one of those is this, that the Lord certainly brought Elijah to Zarephath for the benefit of Elijah, but he's also brought him there for the benefit of this woman, and how we've seen through him and the things that God has enabled him to do and how God has done things apart from Elijah, that this woman's understanding and knowledge of the true and living God has increased. After these things, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill, and he grew much worse until no breath of life remained in him. He died. He died. Some time has passed. We don't know how long at this point, but Elijah's been there for some time now. And every day, he and this woman in her household were miraculously provided for by God. Day in, day out, no breaks, no time off. They've seen it week after week, month after month. Perhaps now it could have been as much as a year or more than a year. They've seen God provide for them consistently the whole time. The sad thing with people sometimes is this is when things go like that for some time that we begin to forget how special and how miraculous and how wonderful those things happen to be. Things grow old for us sometimes. And there's a possibility that the uniqueness of what was going on with them was beginning to fade a little bit in their eyes. Maybe they were beginning to take things for granted. Unlike everyone else around them, you need to understand that they were living in this place and everyone else around them was starving and people were dying. But in the midst of that, God has provided for them through very special, miraculous means. Suddenly, the son becomes ill. And we're not talking about a slight illness. We're not talking about a cold. We're not talking about something even just like the flu, even whatever. We're talking about something, a disease that was deadly. What exactly it was, we don't know. But we do know this, that, and we don't know how long it took, but eventually the son died from this illness. I want you to understand something, that the word we translate here is as ill is one that's used in a variety of different ways, and it actually appears in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 10, where it talks about how God put the suffering servant to grief. So we need to understand something, that this illness was one that led to grief, great grief, on the part of this mother. The breath of life leaves. Well, we understand some things today in a lot, probably higher degree than a lot of folks before. Now, do you think that people for almost since the very beginning, and probably from the very beginning, understood that breathing was an important thing for people to do? And it was something they had to do consistently, constantly. And if they held their breath, eventually they would pass out or they might die from it. Or if they went swimming and they went under the water and they couldn't take breath, that they would drown. I imagine it took very long for people to figure that kind of thing out. Now, exactly why? What was it in air or in a breath that was so important to life? They probably didn't have a clue. Well, we know a lot more now, and we understand that it's the oxygen that we breathe in, that our lungs pick up, transferred to our blood, our circulatory system, and it's carried to absolutely every single cell in your body. Now, how many cells do you think you have in your body? 100, 200, 500, 10,000, a billion, just trillions. There are trillions of those little cells in you, and all your different organs and tissues are made from different types of cells, but every single one of them has to have an unbroken supply of oxygen. And if you break off that supply, then death ensues. And I just bring this to your attention so you'll understand kind of the sense of what underlies all of this, the breath, that absolutely essential, necessary thing that we get from air is suddenly taken away from me. Medically, it's called tissue anoxia. And if you think about it, most of the ways that people die have something to do with it. Tissue anoxia is what kills people most of the time. If your respiratory system shuts down, what happens? You're oxygen deprived. Neurological problems may cause you to be oxygen deprived. You have pneumonia. What causes your death? You're being oxygen deprived. We need to understand that breath of life here goes way beyond that. There's a sense in which what it's referring to is the life that comes from the Lord. And he sends it where he will. And he takes it back when he wills to do that. She said to Elijah, "What do you have against me, O man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and to put my son to death?" Can you imagine? Can you imagine when this prophet guy came some months before this, maybe a year or two before this, and gave her this story or told her that if she would just give him a little bit to eat out of what little she has left, then she and her son and the prophet will be provided for by God through this drought and famine that is killing everybody else around them. In other words, she's seen God miraculously save her and Elijah and also her son. And so you can imagine she would be even more beside herself when suddenly this son that God has gone through so much trouble to keep alive suddenly dies. Now, some of you have lost children. And I can't imagine anything worse than that for a parent to endure is losing one of your children to death. It's not supposed to happen that way. Parents are supposed to pass first, then kids. Some of us can at least to some degree appreciate where she is. This son was her life. And now he's gone. It's interesting here that she doesn't really lay down the idea that God just allowed this boy to die, or Elijah just allowed this boy to die, that in fact they killed him with intention. Sadly, in those days, people very often believed ridiculous things. And one of the ridiculous things that they believed was that the death of a child could atone for the sins of a parent. Now, that sounds crazy. What we're talking about here is child sacrifice, right? I mean, why would people sacrifice their children? They sacrificed their children because the idea there was that God was very, very angry at you, and the only way you could appease his wrath is to give him the thing that's very most precious to you, your own children. Can you imagine anybody ever being more self-centered than that? But it was a common thing in those days. is probably what this Sidonian woman knew. People sacrifice children to their god Baal. So it shouldn't surprise us that the woman would have this perspective that you can actually take away sins, the guilt of sins or whatever, from one person by killing another person. Just to give you an example of this, Manasseh, do you know who Manasseh was? He was one of the kings of Israel. Or Judah? King of Judah. Very wicked king. We are told of him that indeed he offered up he burned his sons as an offering to a pagan god. My reason for even bringing this up is so we'll understand that this woman probably had some reason in her mind to believe, or the common thought in those days was you could, your sins could be forgiven you if the life of your child was taken from you. Now, we understand that that's not true, right? We understand that Jesus made that very, very true. God actually made it very true in Genesis chapter 2 when he had told Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, but he stopped him before he did it. What's the message there? God takes no delight in child sacrifice, even though it was very common in those days. Firstly, for us, the Bible does make this very clear. If you look at Ezekiel chapter 18, verse 20, it says, "The person whose sins will die, the son will not bear the punishment of the father's iniquity, nor will the father bear the punishment for the son's iniquity. The righteousness of the righteous will be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked will be upon himself." In other words, no, this son, God did not take this son, God did not kill this son because of her sins. Now, let me just say this, that our sins have a far-reaching effect, and we need to understand that some of the things that we've done in our life, some of the worst good things we've done, have in part been because of the good examples of people that we've had go before us and the people around us. But at the same time, we understand this, that we've all done wickedly, we've all done evilly, we've never done 100% right when it comes to anything. But do you understand even pagan idol worshipers believe that when crimes are committed against God, judgment has to be passed? There has to be satisfaction made. John chapter 9 gives us an example of the idea that it was still very prevalent in that day. If you're familiar with it, there's a blind man, a man who was born blind there, that Jesus miraculously, he gives his sight back to him. But what even starts this whole thing going is the disciples coming to Jesus and saying to him, you know what they say to him? They say, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind?" See, they're trying to make some sense out of it. Because you hear you have a blind man, and you need to understand that the teaching they were receiving in those days is this: if someone was blind, they were blind because of their sin, because God struck them with blindness because they were really, really bad sinners. Anyone that was afflicted like that, it was a result of the fact that they were not being obedient, not doing according to the laws of God. We understand this, and that is that sin must be atoned for, right? the penalty must be applied. But Jesus, he's the only one who's ever been able to take the guilt of sin from anyone else. And he does it fully, and he does it completely. I don't know about you, but I still feel guilty. Do you ever feel guilty? Do you realize that if we really believe and understand the fullness of the gospel, there's no reason for us to ever feel guilty about things? Because our guilt has been taken away. All people are unrighteous. Therefore, Jesus is the only sacrifice that will save anyone from the consequences of their sin. Think about how the death of a son would affect this widowed woman. She has no husband, therefore she has no male to provide for her. When we consider the culture in which she was living, we understand that women were looked down upon by men. Men were superior. Women were just kind of there to do the menial labor and chores and have kids and keep the guy satisfied. We know this. That very often sons took care of moms when they became aged. In other words, we need to look and consider how she's looking at the circumstance, and that is this, is one of the things, one of the securities she had in that son was knowing that as he grew up, that he would take care of her, and when she got to the point, she couldn't do that. So her loss is not a small loss. I've read something. You've seen things and you've heard things lately. I know you have, that are just very disturbing. They're just unbelievably disturbing. You're looking at things and you're going, how in the world can that be? I read something recently, I was so astounded by it, I could hardly believe it when I read it, and that is this, is that they're saying that today, lots of couples are waiting until they're 40 or 50 years old to have children. Part of that is they want to live their life of fun and pleasure and leisure and do all the fun stuff and all that. They don't want to be tied down by children and things like that. But when you hear the reason they're giving, it'll sadden your heart. Because what they're saying is they want to have children so they'll have somebody to take care of them as they get older. Now, can you imagine a worse reason for having a kid? But this is where our culture is today. Just imagine, can you be that? Can you put yourself in the shoes of that woman, even for the briefest moment? In a sense, her whole life was invested in her son. In a sense, her whole life has just ended because now her son is no longer there. Her heart is in grief. She's holding her son to her bosom. Now, we can hold people in different ways, right? But there's something deep here that comes through when you consider what is being conveyed. She's holding her son as close to her heart as she possibly can. Clinging to him. He said to her, "Give me your son." And he took him from her bosom, and he carried him to the upper room where he was staying and laid him on his bed. Now let's get this straight. the man whom she's just accused of purposely being, at least in cohorts with God, in the killing of her son, is now saying to her, give his body to me. Do you think she would be inclined to do that? The surprising thing, one of the most amazing things is this, is she does it. She gives his body to Elijah. Elijah carries them upstairs to an upper room where she's given him to stay. So notice here, when he came there, he had no food, he had no water, he had no place to live. And now God, through this woman, has provided all of those things for him. He has his own little bedroom upstairs. And there's a bed there that he sleeps on that she's provided for him. As we read all of this, there should be some things coming to mind if we're familiar with Elijah's protege, Elisha. He comes after Elijah. But there's a lot of similarities between things that happen in the life of Elijah compared to the life of Elisha. Something very similar to this happens with Elisha, where there's a lady that has given him an upper room. And when he was passing through Shunem, then he would go there and he would stay there. And he had a bed in that room. And he was so touched by, Elisha was so touched by the generosity and the graciousness of this lady that he asked Gehazi, his servant, what could he do for her? What would be a special gift I could give to her? And what Gehazi said was, she has no son. So God gave her a son. But what happened? After time, that son died. See the similarity between these stories? And she took the body of her son, her dead son, to Elisha, and Elisha took him and laid him on his bed. And the breath of life returned to him. Boy, this is really neat stuff in this sense. And we're going to see things like this at different places in the Bible where God uses different means of miraculous supernatural actions to accomplish his desired end. We see the presence of the spirits of God being very powerfully present with particular people, which seems to go beyond what you would find with everybody else. Now, the people that really stand out, God's spirit was so strong upon Elijah. God's spirit was so strong upon Elisha. Elisha, when he was dead, they buried him. Later on, they cast the body of someone on the grave of Elisha, and when he touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood up on his feet. What about the Apostle Paul? Would you say that the Spirit of God was very strong upon Paul compared to lots of other people, that there was a real sense of God's presence there that you didn't find with just everybody? We're told in Acts chapter 19 that God was performing extraordinary miracles by the hands of Paul, so that handkerchiefs or aprons were even carried from his body to the sick, and the disease left them and the evil spirits went out. That material, cloth, handkerchiefs, just touching the body of Paul could be taken now and laid upon the sick and they would be healed because of it. What about Peter? They even carried the sick into the streets and laid them on cots and pallets so that when Peter came by, at least his shadow might fall on any one of them, and they were being healed. Can you imagine? He cried out to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, did you bring distress also upon this widow with whom I'm staying by killing her son? Elijah's just as surprised as she is. He's shocked. He can't understand why God has saved this boy only now to kill him. He questions the distress that's been brought on this woman who's been so good to him, who's been so kind to him. How can it be? Why? Why did this happen, God? Do you ever crawl to God and say, why did this happen? Well, we can't say for absolute certainty about some things, but we can certainly derive some things from things. What I mean is we don't know definitively why. We just know that God did, right? But if you go back to John chapter 9, where we were talking about the man who was born blind, Jesus basically tells the disciples why this guy was born blind. He says it was that the works of God might be displayed in him. In other words, what he was saying to his disciples is, this man in part was born blind for your benefit, because so you could be here today and you could see and experience what is about to happen when I heal that man. Can we say the same thing about this little boy that's now dead? I think we can. That God had a purpose in it. And the purpose of it was to show forth his glory. By bringing this dead boy back to life. A resurrection. Just remember this, guys. Resurrection is Old Testament too. It's not the only one. Can you think of anything that with a stronger voice cries out that this is a God thing than that? What I'm saying is, he did it with willful intent, and he did it for purposes to bless, in essence, the mother, even though it didn't look like a blessing to start with. Can you imagine how much more precious that son was her now after he's died and he comes back to life? He also did it for Elijah. That he would be encouraged in his faith. And you know what's in the Bible today for you and I to read it? So that when we read it, we study it, and God works in us, we can be encouraged. We have to remember this. How could you possibly have a resurrection if somebody didn't die? How could you heal a blind person if someone wasn't blind? How could you heal the deaf if someone wasn't deaf? In other words, this boy died for a purpose, and that purpose was to be raised from the dead again for the glory of God. Now, what do you think that did for Elijah's faith? What do you think it did for the faith of this woman? What about the boy? Can you imagine sitting around later on in life with your mom and whoever happened to be there? Maybe there was some of the other family, extended family, uncles, aunts, and cousins and stuff like that, or just friends. You're sitting there and she tells over and over again the story about the day that God brought you back to life. Can you imagine? The truth is, guys, if we are believing, we have a very similar story to tell. The day that God brought us to spiritual life, after being dead to Him. I miss those times when my grandparents, we used to sit around with my grandmother sometimes, and we would just talk and talk and talk for hours, and she tells all the stories about when she was a little kid and things like that, and we loved it. And I think this is an area of our culture that is sorely hurting from today, and that is that families don't tend to do that kind of thing anymore. They rarely eat with each other. They sit at the table maybe together, and then they will go through dinner, and the next thing you're up, they're up doing this, that, and the other, and whatever. Where's the conversation that used to take place? What stories are we passing on to the younger people around us? Three times he stretched out on the child and cried out to the Lord and said, "Lord, my God, let the breath of life now return to the body of this child." That sounds kind of strange. And you just need to picture this. Here's the bed in the upper room. The boy's laying on it, and now Elijah crawls up on the bed and stretches himself out over the boy. Incidentally, Elisha does basically the same thing in the story we referred to a few minutes earlier. He does the same thing. And you and I are stuck here with the idea of why. Why in the world would he get up on top of him and kind of spread himself out over this young boy? Why? What was the purpose of that? Well, we can't really say. I mean, we can speculate. He certainly has reasons for doing it. And it worked. But maybe it's something along these lines. We understand that living things only pass life on. In other words, for something to be able to pass life on to what comes after it, its offspring, it must have life itself first. Maybe, in a sense, what was going on here was the idea that the bread of life that is still in me, I'm sharing that bread of life with you. But who knows? It's what he did. And the Lord heard Elijah cry out. And the soul, life, spirit of the child returned to him, and he lived. The prophet cried out. And God did. Now let me ask you something. Do you think Elijah convinced God that's what he needed to do? I mean, what's going on here was this. But maybe God made a mistake. He shouldn't have really struck down this young boy and all of that. And Elijah's appealing to him to be merciful and graceful, gracious and all that kind of stuff. And there's some way in which Elijah changes God's mind. And so God sends the soul of the son back to him. There are a lot of people that believe that. And let me just tell you this. If you believe that's what prayer is for, you misunderstand prayer completely. Prayer is not an opportunity that God gives us to convince him to do stuff we want him to do. Most people, that's what prayer says. When you hear people pray, that's mostly what they're praying. It's like you're trying to convince God that he needs to do something you want him to do. That's not what prayer is at all. Because let me tell you, you cannot change God's mind. No one's ever changed God's mind, nor will anyone ever change God's mind. And if they did, there would be no God. He's sovereign. Absolutely. Completely. Totally. He's doing here what he predetermined he was going to do. Elijah's not convincing him to rethink things and turn things around. Well, we know a lot today, and we know that there's a material part of us. And you need to understand that most modern scientists believe that's it, that we are material and that's it. There's nothing, you know, immaterial about us, that even our emotions, everything about us are basically functions of our physical body. Now, we understand things differently. We understand that there's a material part of us and there's an immaterial part of us. And we know that the material part can die, and it often does. But the material part doesn't. And very often we call that material part the immaterial part, our soul or our spirit. You could call it the breath of life, essence of life. The boy was really dead. For a time. His spirit left, but then it returned. Resurrection, guys, this is a prelude to the resurrection coming. That time when the body of everyone that has ever lived will be raised from the earth. And the spirit soul will be reunited with it. And we understand that resurrection is going to be wonderful for some people. People who know Jesus, is going to be the greatest day of their whole existence. May be the greatest day for all of eternity for them. But we also know this, that those who live apart from Christ will stand God's judgment. And rightfully so. Now, how can I say that? It's because God never does anything wrong. And we may not understand all of that, but God never makes any mistakes. Now, that sounds like a fairy tale or something. It sounds like you could read something like that in, you know, some of the old fairy tale books or maybe some of the new stuff going on now. You know, all the things like Frozen and all that kind of stuff, these fairy tale kind of stories and all of that. But we need to understand this is not a fairy tale. It's reality. The day of resurrection is coming, and everyone will be resurrected. Can you imagine the joy of that mother? And what was she rejoicing in? Well, she was rejoicing that even though her son was dead, now he's alive. But I would say it goes even deeper than that. Because in it and through it, she comes to understand there is a God. There's a God who's living. He's Elijah's God. He's her God. You may be going through trials and tribulations right now. But But if you're a child of God, be assured he will never leave you. He will never fail you. He will always be there for you. And he will always do the very best for you. It may not smell like it. It may not feel like it. It may not taste like it. But whatever it is, we need to understand. It's for us. Because we need it. God's not working against us. Sometimes I think we have that idea. He's not. He never is. He never does.